This is Democracy,
a podcast about the people of the United States,
a podcast about citizenship,
about engaging with politics and the world around you,
a podcast about educating yourself on today's important issues
and how to have a voice in what happens next.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. This week, we have the great privilege of speaking with one of the most experienced, accomplished, and influential figures in American relations with Ukraine and the wider East European region. This is Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. She's recently published a really stunning memoir that I encourage everyone to read called Lessons from the Edge, and we'll talk about why it's the edge for her. She is a long-serving American ambassador. She was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 2016 to 2019. Before that, the ambassador to Armenia from 2008 to 2011. And before that, to the Kyrgyz Republic from 2005 to 2008. She's also held many high-ranking policy positions in the State Department, in the building, as people call it. She served as Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, and there she coordinated European and global security issues. And before that, she was the Bureau's Deputy Assistant Secretary, responsible for issues related to the Nordic, Baltic, and Central European countries. So she has studied this region and worked in this region for quite a long time, since the late 1980s. And of course, this is the larger region surrounding the current war in Ukraine. So we're going to talk to the ambassador about the ways in which U.S. policy has evolved in this region and the ways we should understand the evolution of that policy for current challenges surrounding Ukraine and democratization in the region as a whole. Ambassador, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we turn to our discussion, of course, we have our scene-setting poem from Mr. Zachary Suri. What's the title of your poem, Zachary?
Ode to President Zelensky.
Well, let's hear the ode to President Zelensky.
They say yours is a land of poetry, and I believe it, because only the poet, now the plumber, the teacher, the student, can walk in front of a tank, can radio obscenities to the enemy from an aisle of snakes. They say yours is a land of poetry. You walk the streets red-eyed in front of the palaces in the early dawn hours, your smile fading majestically into resolution. I would like to see the poetry of the child waiting in the metro station for the bombs to fall. I would like to see the poetry of the mother holding that child on the border, trying to cross into humanity. I would like to see the poetry of the father and his Molotov patrolling the streets of his city at dawn. Maybe he runs into you because you are there too, and you are holding your child too, and you are waiting also to cross into humanity. They say yours is a land of poetry, and I remember it now, how they walked Kharkiv and took their lyrics from the city in snow that holds back an empire now. The city in snow that holds your fate in its hands. The city in snow where the missile hits the apartment block and you bow your head and pray. They say yours is a land of poetry. I'd like to visit it someday and walk the streets that they did and hold the staircase banisters that they did, running down to the bomb shelter at 4 a.m. when Kyiv is bombed. And maybe I'd run into you because you are there too, and you are holding your child too, and you are waiting also to cross into humanity.
That's a very moving poem, Zachary. What is your poem about?
My poem is really about the power of telling a story of humanitarian and humanist leadership in the midst of such inhuman violence.
Well, I think that is a dark opening, but an opening I think that's appropriate for our conversation today. Ambassador, how did you get interested and involved? You talk about this in the first 100 pages or so of your memoir. How did you get involved in this part of the world, which has such a long history of warfare and, if we might say so, inhumane experiences between different societies?
Well, if I could just echo your words of praise for the poem, because, and it directly relates to the answer I'm going to give you, because, you know, there are big geopolitical events like war and famine and all the things that we're seeing now, but it all does boil down to our own humanity and individuals and how individuals deal with those things, how individuals lead us through these crises, hopefully towards a, you know, a more positive future. So my parents grew up in this region. That's where my roots are. My father was born in the Soviet Union in 1921. He grew up in what was then Yugoslavia and was taken prisoner of war by the Nazis and lived in wartime Paris after he escaped. And my mom was half Russian, and she grew up as a stateless person because she was half Russian in Nazi Germany, not a comfortable upbringing there. And they both saw all sorts of horrific things, and they both understood what it was to live under authoritarian regimes where you are not free and where you are afraid. And, you know, they met in Canada and made their way to the United States with me. And they were always grateful to have safe harbor in the United States, to be able to bring up my brother and I in a democracy where they could say what they wanted to say, where they could believe what they wanted to believe, go to church and worship in the way they wanted to worship. And they taught us not to take it for granted. And they also taught us, even though materially we had very little, although we were very rich in the things that count, that we were fortunate. We were fortunate to be in the United States and to have all that opportunity, and that we needed to give back. And so, you know, many detours in my life, as I'm sure there are in many of our listeners' lives, but in my late 20s, I came back to an original idea that I had in my teens of joining the Foreign Service, working in the State Department, working on foreign policy, marrying up my passion for history and politics and foreign policy and traveling. And after all, this is a career that pays you to travel. And, you know, how lucky can you get, right? And the idea of giving back to the American people who had given so much to our family. So, you know, that all kind of came together. And I joined the Foreign Service in 1986.
And I just want to highlight this. You mentioned this in passing in your memoir, but it's important because many of my students are pursuing the same career path. The first time you took the Foreign Service exam, you did not pass, correctly. And I only bring that up because that happens to a lot of my students as well.
Yeah.
But yet, obviously, it didn't stop you from having an incredible career, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I didn't pass the first time. I took it again and I passed. I had a number of, stumbles, if not outright failures in the early part of my career where, you know, I wanted to do certain kind of work. I wanted to do political analysis and reporting. I was not able to do that, even though I tried in various ways. You know, I persisted, I volunteered, I did all sorts of things. In the end, I was lucky enough to be a beneficiary of a class action lawsuit that had started decades before I joined the Foreign Service. The State Department fought it for decades, and eventually a court found that the State Department was discriminating against women in the exam, in the intake, in how they assigned people their specialties, in how they assigned people, their women, their jobs, and how they promoted them. So across the board, discrimination. And I was fortunate enough to be one of 14 women who was offered a remedy in 1992. And that really started me on my career for what I wanted to do. And I only bring this up that persistence is really important in the face of setbacks and failure. But, you know, sometimes even persistence isn't enough. And, you know, maybe there are other remedies like the law. To help us move our institutions along and make those institutions live up to our ideals.
And just to add a little bit to that, and you talk about this in really interesting detail in your memoir, this was the lawsuit filed by, I believe, Alison Palmer,
right.
who was a generation, maybe two generations before you in the State Department, correct?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
So how did you then come to your work in Ukraine, which was actually, I think, your first posting back to this region as a DCM, if I'm not mistaken, right? As basically the number two in the embassy there. How did that happen? Yeah.
Well, I had served in Uzbekistan on temporary duty. I served in Moscow for 3 years in the early 1990s. I was interested in the region in part because of my roots. I had studied Russian in college, again, because of my roots, but it was also during the Cold War. So if you were interested in foreign policy, national security, Russian was a good language to have. All of a sudden in 1991, I mean, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, I mean, the decay was evident for decades, but the Soviet Union fell apart. There were, you know, instead of just one country, the Soviet Union, there were 15 countries, all of which needed new embassies and staffing and everything else. So there was a lot of opportunity for people who had studied the region or knew the language, were interested in going. And worked on the area both, you know, when I was in Russia, obviously, from 1993 to 96, but also I came back to Washington and worked on, I was the deputy director of the Russia desk. And worked with closely with the man who was eventually named ambassador to Ukraine, and he asked me to be his number two, and so I went out in 2001, and that was just a fascinating period of time to be there.
And what's really interesting to me about that chapter, and it's a long chapter in your memoir, and it's part of your background I didn't know when you became famous later on, but what was really interesting to me about it was you talk in depth about the problems of corruption and mismanagement in Ukraine, the efforts by the Ukrainians at times to cover up misdeeds and things of that sort. It's different, of course, from the image we want to tell ourselves about current Ukraine. If you could just reflect on that, because it'll obviously be relevant when we talk about current events.
So all of the countries of the former Soviet Union, the new countries that emerged, had the legacy of the Soviet Union to deal with. And corruption flourishes in countries that do not provide services to their people, that do not govern well, because the leaders are too busy stealing to, actually fix roads or have good schools or good medical systems and everything else. But people are going to find a way. And that is, and they're watching, of course, the example of their leaders stealing, millions and billions. And so they're paying bribes left, right, and center to get that telephone. This was back in the days of landlines, get that telephone installed, or electricity turned on, or the right medication for their sick child in the hospital, because you're going to find a way to get what you need, right? And so there was in the Soviet Union, there the system was corruption, and so when all of these countries emerged, it wasn't like all of a sudden all of that went away. So even as countries were trying to develop democracies in what was formerly a communist state, trying to develop, capitalism, market economies in, what was a command economy. These legacy systems continued to flourish. And as there were gaps in laws and regulations, and as there were opportunities to steal, the young and the bold and the very connected in, the military or especially the security services found ways to snag the state-owned properties that were being privatized, because ordinary citizens didn't understand the concept of privatization, the concept that, a voucher for a part of a factory actually held real value. I'm not saying it was illegal, but you could certainly make a case that what was going on was deeply unfair, deeply immoral, and, kind of set the stage for ordinary citizens to say, well, gosh, if this is democracy, if this is the market economy, you can keep it. It was better in the old days, even as they were pocketing some of the really positive things that were happening in their countries, they would look back fondly to the old days. And so, fast forward to 2001, That was 10 years after independence, and a whole new crew of, you know, 20 somethings, 30 somethings who had, you know, been educated, slightly after, after the fall apart of the Soviet Union. So not as indoctrinated. There was a whole class of civil society activists that were coming up, and, crucially investigative journalists, and they were, you know, making inroads and trying to set up the democracy that they knew Ukraine could be. And they were really active and really inspiring. And, you know, it was just a flourishing of society, even against the entrenched interests that really didn't want to move forward. So that was something that I really admired in Ukrainians in 2001 to 2004 when I was there the first time. And the reason that I wanted to go back in 2016 after the Revolution of Dignity.
And what role did you and others in the U.S. Embassy, and what role as a whole did U.S. policy play in trying to counter corruption and support those heroic activists that you've just described?
In what period of time?
Well, throughout the period. I mean, I'm actually thinking of your coverage in your memoir of your time in Ukraine, also in Kyrgyzstan and elsewhere. And one of the reasons I asked the question is there's often the criticism made that the United States didn't do enough and that we contributed to corruption in the region.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's very valid criticism, that certainly when I was in Ukraine the first time, anti-corruption, I mean, we could see the corruption, people talked about it. But it was not a part of really, or a big part at least, of our policy discussions with the Ukrainians. It was not a part of our assistance programs to, you know, sort of have anti-corruption programming. We could see it, but it was like the elephant in the room that nobody, you know, we were all too polite to mention it. So we were working with the Ukrainians to try to help them build a market economy. And yet, you know, the foundation of what should be a healthy, thriving economy in a country that is relatively rich was constantly being nibbled away by corruption. And so contrast that with 2016, when I returned, where when I presented my credentials to President Poroshenko, he raised the issue of corruption. I mean, I think if we had talked to President Kuchma in 2001 about corruption, we would have been thrown out of the room. But civil society, the people of Ukraine, were the ones that were moving this agenda of anti-corruption forward over the years. And in 2014, there was the Revolution of Dignity, which means I want to be treated with dignity. I don't want to have to pay bribes for something that is, you know, my due as a citizen of Ukraine. And, you know, it was basically rule of law. We want to live under the rule of law, and we want to be able to hold our leaders accountable when they steal from us. And by, you know, some accounts, by some measures, President Yanukovych, who was the leader in 2014, he and his cronies stole $40 billion from Ukraine. And so that revolution, you know, there was a real basis for people being unhappy. And when they were successful and, you know, chased Yanukovych out of the country, the new president, President Poroshenko, even though he was an oligarch himself, he came in on a platform of anti-corruption. And so it was the people, the activists, the government itself with that platform, and crucially also the international community, whether it was the international financial institutions like IMF or the World Bank, whether it was the EU, the US, others, we all kind of came together, and there was a negotiation of what steps Ukraine was going to take on this anti-corruption move. The international community was willing to help fund it, help pay for it, support it. But we were pretty tough you know, told the Ukrainians that they needed to take certain steps, and then we would provide, you know, the funding, that we were not willing to continue to pay, you know, sort of into a bottomless black hole of business as usual. And even then, with, you know, such momentum for the fight against corruption, It was tough because, you know, change is hard under any circumstances. And, you know, that is true in Ukraine, just as it is true in the United States. And arguably, the conditions there were harder in 2014.
And what role did Russia play in all of this? I think maybe for many of our listeners, that's the key question at the moment. How has Russia shaped this region in the years since 1991? And what role do you see it is playing at the moment?
Yeah, well, so for the first 10 years of independence under President Yeltsin, Russia was working towards democracy, working towards establishing a market economy. We had a pretty good relationship with Russia, and crucially on important security issues, including nuclear issues, which was, this is going back a while, but, you know, we were very concerned about loose nukes in Russia and Ukraine and Kazakhstan. Would countries have the ability to safeguard these, maintain them, because that requires a lot of money, a lot of sophistication, a lot of commitment when, you know, countries are, you know, new countries and having to a lot of other priorities as well. So we had a, it's hard to believe now, given, you know, some of the propaganda that is being put out by Russia, but we had a really, a positive relationship with Russia, and we worked very hard to include Russia in the international community. President Clinton invited President Yeltsin to join the Group of Eight, which is, it had been the Group of Seven, the seven largest economies in the world. Russia was not the, eighth largest economy in the world, but we wanted them at the table. We wanted to bring them in so that they would understand that working within the global rules-based system was an advantage, not just to us, but for Russia as well. And, it's hard to believe, but, we were talking about maybe one day Russia joining the EU, even NATO. Even Putin was talking in that way in the very, very beginning of his years in power. But then he took a very hard right turn over the early 2000s or the mid 2000s, and we can see the result. So that was really unfortunate.
And Ambassador, I just want to ask you now, because it's a question that comes up quite often. Do you think the expansion of NATO alienated Russia?
I actually think that's a red herring. I think that Russia uses it, and certainly used it as a pretext to invade or reinvade, I should say, Ukraine in February of this year. But I mean, look at all the things that Putin has said. On the eve of the war, where he thought it'd be a couple of days and he would take Kyiv and all of Ukraine. He was already setting his sights for countries further west. He has repeatedly talked about the international order as something that, is not a positive thing, even though even Russia benefits from it. And he has, just recently, last week, compared himself to Peter the Great and talked about how he is going to reabsorb lands that are Russian. I don't think this really has much to do with NATO. And I think it also bears repeating once again that it's not like NATO in the early 1990s was looking to expand and beat the drums and force other countries to join NATO. Other countries asked to join NATO, and they did it even at the time because they wanted security guarantees. They remembered Russian history and Russia's long history of invading their countries, and they were not sanguine that the peace that we saw, mostly saw in the 1990s, at least in that part of Europe, was going to last. And, now we're looking at possibly another enlargement of NATO with Sweden and Finland. And again, why is that? It is precisely because of Russian actions. You know, the very thing that Putin says he didn't want, an expansion of NATO, he's getting because of the aggressive actions of his country.
Right. I mean, in a certain way, recent events have redeemed the arguments made by the Poles and others for the necessity of NATO, it seems to me. I wanted us to get back to your time then as ambassador to Ukraine, which began in 2016. This was your second tour of duty there. You had been in the embassy earlier. When you returned as ambassador, and this is obviously when things become very quickly complicated with the new Trump administration, what were your main goals? What were you working on in Ukraine in that period as ambassador?
Yeah, so our policy towards Ukraine hasn't really changed since 1991 when Ukraine gained independence. You know, it's sort of, you know, three legs of a stool. The first is security, a security partnership. The second is an economic relationship, and the third is a political relationship. And, you know, we worked with Ukraine, as we did with Russia and other countries of the former Soviet Union, to help them build up their security so that, you know, one of the things that we look for in our security partners is interoperability and an ability to do, you know, when we have goals in common, whether it's against terrorists or pirates or, you know, other missions around the world, that we can work with other countries and make it a, you know, a multi-partnership sort of a thing. So we worked with Ukraine on that, and also trying to help them reform their military so it wasn't the kind of top-down, heavy, corrupt institution that you can see in Russia, but more of a modern military that relies on non-commissioned officers, that is more flexible, where procurements are overseen by, you know, by the legislature, that are transparent so that there's less opportunity for graft and corruption. On the political side, the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian government, since the very first days, said that they wanted to become a democracy. We thought that that would be good for Ukraine, that, you know, most people, you know, whether it's in the U.S. or in Ukraine or someplace else, they don't talk about wanting to live in a democracy as though they were a bunch of political scientists in a classroom. They talk about wanting to have opportunity, to wanting to live in security, wanting to have a good job so they can take care of their families, so that wanting, you know, the government to provide services so that their kids can get a good education and a good job later on. And they want accountability so that if they don't like their mayor or their president, they can throw the bum out and, you know, elect somebody else instead. That's democracy. And it's not a perfect system, but it's the best one out there. And so I, you know, we thought that would be good for Ukraine, and we definitely thought it would be good for the United States, because democracies make better partners for the United States. Period, paragraph. We have, you know, we share values, but democracies are generally also more stable and more stable in their region. And then, of course, the important commercial and economic relationship. Ukraine's a huge country with a huge market and lots of resources. And so we saw a lot of opportunity for American business, creating jobs in America, creating profits in America. And so we wanted to build up those relationships. But that also depended on rule of law, so that when American companies are in Ukraine, they know that they can rely on the rules as written, that the court system is an open one and a fair one. And, you know, judicial opinions are not based on payment by one or the other party. So we had a pretty big agenda with Ukraine, and it has continued with bipartisan support since 1991. Now, with the revolution in 2014, the Revolution of Dignity, which really kind of jump-started a lot of reforms because it was coming directly, that desire was coming directly from the people. We, you know, really jump-started, again, you know, our efforts to help the Ukrainians. And so I think that was an important part of it.
And what happened then as you were pursuing this agenda, which sounds vital and reasonable and appropriate, an agenda for basic building democratic institutions and creating the foundations for a better partnership between the United States and Ukraine? What happened with the Trump administration to undermine your efforts?
Well, you know, the the crazy thing is the official U.S. foreign policy, in other words, Trump's foreign policy, did not change over that time. I mean, if you look at statements made and everything else, but there was an undercurrent that perhaps President Trump himself was not completely comfortable with that, given his statements about Russia, about Putin, about Crimea being a part of Russia, and on and on. But the actual policy didn't change. And in fact, it was strengthened in one way that President Trump agreed to send, you know, after about a year, he agreed to send javelins, those anti-tank missiles, to Ukraine for the first time, something the Obama administration had refused to do. So ironically, on the one hand, you know, the policy was good and we were continuing to implement it and going full force. And it had, as I said, bipartisan support on the Hill. But, you know, we were always wondering, you know, when would the next shoe drop from President Trump? And then, you know, in 2018, I was starting to hear rumblings that, you know, maybe I might be replaced. And at the end of 2018, I was told by a Ukrainian cabinet member that that in fact there was a plan to do this, that a corrupt prosecutor named Lutsenko was working with Americans to get rid of me. And, you know, when I would go back to Washington, my part of Washington, official, professional Washington, they were like, no, that's crazy. You're doing a great job. And in fact, in February, I was asked to stay on for another year. But there was a parallel track, the Giuliani track. And they were working a deal with the Ukrainians to see if they could get dirt on the Biden family that would perhaps embarrass them and be advantageous to Trump in a possible presidential matchup in our presidential elections. And part of the quid pro quo was, I know that Poroshenko wanted Trump to endorse him for president, but I think Lutsenko wanted me out of the country because he did not like me and he did not like the efforts of the U.S. Embassy to fulfill our U.S. policy goals, but also Ukrainian policy goals to fight corruption. And ultimately, those two were successful in having me removed from Ukraine. And I'd just like to make one other point about that. While that was, you know, obviously deeply, deeply distressing for me, it went well beyond me because, you know, as we know, presidents are, you know, it is in their mandate. They get to name ambassadors, they get to remove ambassadors. But what happened with me was there was a whole publicly orchestrated campaign to accuse me of all sorts of wrongdoing. And then ostensibly that was the reason that I was pulled out of post when there was no necessity for anything like that. Trump could have removed me, period, paragraph. Without making it a big public deal. So anybody paying attention knew that there was something else going on. It wasn't entirely clear what was going on, but knew something else was going on. But the effect on our national security was greater because bad actors, whether it's private actors in the United States, like Giuliani and his cohort, or corrupt actors abroad, they could see that if there was an ambassador or somebody else that was making life uncomfortable for them, they could cut a deal. They could, right, you know, find what was advantageous to President Trump personally and possibly get that person removed. You know, when they are actually implementing U.S. foreign policy. And I think that sent a shiver of fear through many of my colleagues and probably a shiver of hope, hope. Through many bad actors around the world. It was extremely dangerous for our national security.
Well, and it's very hard to convince countries to make the hard choices about abandoning corruption and implementing democratic systems when we're acting in corrupt ways ourselves, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did these challenges from the Trump administration not only undermine U.S. foreign policy, what effect did they have on this new government under President Zelensky?
Well, I think that, you know, President Zelensky, his background, as you know, is he was an actor and a comedian, a very accomplished businessman. He had set up a multi-million dollar production company based on, you know, his own talents and the talents of his friends from, you know, Crevy Ree, the area he's from. But he was not a politician, and he didn't, you know how the levers of government worked. And so that's what the Ukrainian people wanted. They voted for him as the protest vote against Poroshenko, who they felt, you know, hadn't accomplished enough in 6 years and was getting too comfortable. So they voted Zelensky in with 73% of the vote. And, you know, Zelensky was moving forward with his agenda of trying to end the war in Ukraine, in the Donbass, as well as ending corruption. Those were the 2 points of his platform, with, you know, mixed success. I mean, he was really struggling. His popularity ratings were in the 30s on February 23rd. Then the Russians invaded and he became, you know, the Winston Churchill of our time in camouflage. And, you know, now he's at 94% popularity rating. And, you know, it makes me wonder who are the other 6% exactly.
Right.
But I think, you know, going back to your question, he had no experience in government, no experience with, you know, foreign policy, national security, in a country that was very challenged. And so, you know, he had a couple of congratulatory phone calls with Trump, and then he had the fateful, important phone call that Trump dubbed the perfect phone call in July of 2019, where, you know, Zelensky's mission was to get Trump to approve another order of javelins, those anti-tank missiles, to Ukraine. This is something that had already been funded by the U.S. Congress. But as we now know, the president, President Trump, was holding that up. And so he was on a mission to establish a good relationship with his most important counterpart leader, and also specifically to get those javelins released. And Trump, for his part, was also on a mission. He wanted to get Zelensky to institute investigations into the Biden family to benefit himself personally and politically. This is not a mission on behalf of the American people. He was using his office to benefit himself. That's something that, you know, I've seen and we've all seen in other countries. I never expected to see it in the United States. And so, you know, Zelensky, as, you know, a new president, I can only imagine what was going through his head as he was talking on, you know, his side of the Atlantic during this conversation. And I think, you know, there's an interview which he gave either in September or October of that year, where he basically said he doesn't trust any foreign power. And I think you can draw a straight line from that conversation with Trump to that comment by Zelensky.
Did the actions taken by the Trump administration in removing you in trying to bully Zelensky into turning over dirt on Joe Biden's family, did those actions encourage the Russian invasion?
You know, I think it did, because I think that not only Putin, but perhaps other authoritarian leaders, I mean, they drew solace from the transcript that was released, and, you know, just all the other signals that Trump was sending about Ukraine. I mean, I think it was clear to the Ukrainians, who were always worried about where they stood, not necessarily with the U.S., but with the president of the United States. And I think the same thing is true for Putin. I mean, he could see that Trump very much admired him and, you know, saw Ukraine as the weaker power and one not really, I think, worthy of his Trump's Trump's attention. And so I think it enabled Putin to get away with stuff. And I'll give you an example. In November of 2018, Russia broadened the war in Ukraine to the naval domain. Russia seized 3 Ukrainian vessels and 24 sailors in international waters the weekend after Thanksgiving. And Trump would not allow the State Department, and certainly did not issue one himself, did not issue a statement of any kind. I mean, this is the sort of thing that would be routine. You know, it's a signal to a country like Russia that we're watching. This is not okay. You need to de-escalate while you still can, while you're in international waters and can let those vessels go. But, you know, radio silence, crickets from the United States. And I'm sure the Russians were well aware that there was, you know, lots of phone calls back and forth on the U.S. side, and that, you know, there was no acquiescence from the U.S. You know, 24 hours later, after the Russians had already towed those vessels back to Russia, Nikki Haley went way beyond her officially sanctioned talking points at the U.N. to condemn Russian actions. But it was too late.
Right.
And, you know, people forget about that. And I think they forget about the fact that, you know, the U.S. was thinking that, you know, what else can our response be? And we came up with a couple of steps, including sending warships to the Black Sea. This is something we do routinely, whether it's in the Taiwan Straits, other parts of the world, in the Black Sea. And we do it to signal that commercial lanes are open for you know, other vessels. That we have an interest in that this is vitally important, navigation, free navigation of the seas. And so it was announced, and President Trump saw it on CNN. I mean, he had agreed to it, but then he saw it on CNN, and he worried that Putin wouldn't like it, and he canceled it. These kinds of actions send signals, not only to the Ukrainians, but to the Russians as well.
Do you think that the Biden administration has been able to fix this problem? Have we now reached a point where we've overcome those challenges, or is the legacy still strong?
Well, I think that the Biden administration has done a really good job in very, very difficult circumstances of trying to navigate what is a very narrow channel. Between, on the one hand, supporting Ukraine, deterring Russia, and reinforcing the eastern flank, and on the other hand, you know, not widening the war. Nobody wants a war with Russia. And Russia knows that. And Russia is trying to deter us in all sorts of ways, including reminding in a very irresponsible way that they are a nuclear power and they could use their nuclear might if provoked. And so I think, you know, this is not a static, you know, the answer to your question, it's hard to answer it because it's not a static situation. So on the one hand, I think Putin was surprised by the resolve of the United States, by the ability of NATO and the other Western countries to unify, by, you know, the remarkable fight back from not just the Ukrainian military, but the Ukrainian people and Zelensky's leadership. So, you know, that was all good. But, you know, now we're heading into month 4, and, you know, the attention is drifting. People wonder how long this is going to last. What's going to be the cost to us? And I think what we need to remember is that, yes, this is a war about Ukraine. I mean, Putin, no question, has an obsession about Ukraine and returning it to Mother Russia. But it is also about something bigger, which is this is a war on Europe. Putin has made that clear. And I think if he's successful in the Donbass, he's going to wait and see if he can continue pushing west. And if he can't do it immediately, he will wait and he will regroup. That's been his pattern over time with Georgia in 2008, Ukraine for the first time in 2014. He will do this again. He's told us that he has aims beyond Ukraine and that the international order is one of the, you know, one of the targets in his sights. And so I think we need to take him at his word. If Putin is successful, not only will he continue, maybe not this year, maybe in 10 years, maybe in 5 years, but other autocrats will be emboldened because they will see that countries can get away with imposing force on their neighbors, their weaker neighbors. And, you know, that creates a world that is far more dangerous for us. The international rules-based order, you know, there's a reason that countries, including the Soviet Union, came together after World War II to sort of try to set up principles like sovereignty and non-use of force or the threat of force or the inviolability of borders and the institutions to help us manage them and the treaties and agreements to, you know, give us the guidelines for how to do all of this. Over the last, you know, 70 plus years, we have been, and when I say we, I don't just mean the U.S. I think this includes Russia as well. We have been more secure, more prosperous. Maybe this part doesn't include Russia, and more free. And if Putin is allowed to set the terms of what international engagement looks like post February 24th, it is going to be a far more dangerous, far less prosperous world for all of us.
We always like to close, Ambassador, with some hopeful thoughts, drawing on this history, and you shared so much with us. We haven't talked very much about your personal ordeal, testifying during the impeachment hearings. That's in your book, and I hope our readers will read that. It was a very, very moving part of your book for me. But I do want us to try to close on a somewhat hopeful note. From your long experience that you've shared a little bit of with us right here, what are the opportunities we have going forward? What have we learned in the last 30 years that can help us to do better in this region, in the region around Ukraine, and in a broader sense? Your final chapter of your memoir refers to the Foreign Service and your career as the best America has to offer. What is the best we have to offer going forward?
Well, and it's not just us. You know, I look at the people of Ukraine who I think surprised the world. They didn't surprise me because I know them, but, you know, they want to live in a free country. I mean, they're fighting on giving everything they've got to fight for their country, to fight for their families, to fight for their freedom, to fight for our freedom. That gives me a lot of hope. I mean, I think of how many conversations I've had with people and continue to have with people who, you know, basically don't think, you know, some of these countries should have the right to determine their own futures, that they are smaller countries and, you know, are our bigger issues. You know, we need to deal with the bigger powers and, countries like Ukraine need to kind of put up because they must. And the Ukrainian people will simply not tolerate that. Even if Zelensky were to sign an agreement with everything that Putin wanted. I mean, first of all, you know, just given the 2014-2015 agreements, why do we even think he would honor those agreements? But secondly, the Ukrainian people, they believe in self-determination and they want to be free. And, you know, we started this program about poetry. And Taras Shevchenko, the most famous, the most beloved Ukrainian poet, said, fight on and you will prevail. And that is what the Ukrainian people are doing. And when I look at our own country, whether it's, you know, foreign service officers, civil servants, military people, all of whom, everybody who was asked to testify, even in the face of their agency and the White House telling them not to testify, decided that their greater loyalty was to the Constitution, not to an individual. And I think that should give the American people hope. And I think, you know, about the pandemic and how, you know, so many people kept the country going, you know, whether it was medical workers, whether it was emergency workers, whether it was food deliverers, teachers, others, doing the right thing because we needed them. And so that's the sort of thing that gives me hope. I do believe that we have grave challenges in the United States. And we need to meet them head on, and everybody needs to do their part. But when I look around at me, and when I, you know, some of you know that I work with students as well, and, you know, talk to students who are, you know, ready to get in there and, you know, are idealistic and, you know, are going to fix the mess that my generation has made. You know, that gives me a lot of hope about the future.
Zachary, what do you think?
You know, I think there's a lot of hope out there too. I think that we've all been inspired by the force of will and the determination of the Ukrainian people. And I think, as the ambassador said, we need to not look away. We need to keep looking, and we need to keep paying attention, because whether we like it or not, this fight is going to continue for a long time. And we have a responsibility to make sure that we don't forget the heroism that we've seen, but also that we're able to channel some of those, that same idealism and that same spirit.
Right. As in the past, we can often remember who we are by looking at our activities and our relationships with societies abroad and find inspiration.
Indeed.
As your poem referred to as well. I think it's also always crucial that we bring a longer historical perspective. And Ambassador Yovanovitch, I think your memoir and your discussion today share with us not only your personal experience, but 35, 40 years of history in this region. History that's crucial to understanding how we've come to this moment we are today, but also to see the possibilities. The power of, as you said at the very beginning of our show, Ambassador, the power of individuals and the ways in which individuals can indeed change the world around them and inspire others around them as well. And that's part of the story of Eastern Europe after the end of the Soviet Union, just as also the tragedies we're witnessing are part of that history as well. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you.
And Zachary, thank you for your poem, as always. And most of all, thank you to our loyal listeners for joining us for this episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio
and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harris Codini.
Stay tuned for a new episode every week.
You can find This Is Democracy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
See you next time.